In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
And now, Felix Bonnell. We replayed one of Felix's... He's our resident historian, by the way, in case you're new to Cairo Radio. We played one of Felix's vintage Christmas features last week. It was about Centralia's Magic Radio Santa Claus, a show which started back in the 1950s and ran for years and years and years. And the Magic Radio Santa Claus would read letters to Santa written by local kids over radio station KELA in Centralia. And one of the kids whose letter was read on the old 1950 recording that Felix found was little 7-year-old Jim Hudson, who was asking for a present for his brother who was serving in the Korean War.
And here's a nice letter from, let's see, this is from Chehalis or Centralia. It's from Jim Hudson. He says he wants a sailboat, a Red Ryder BB gun, a basketball, and he says, bring my big brother Eugene something too. I think he might be home for Christmas. He is in Korea.
Well, as it turns out, Jim Hudson of Tumwater heard that story last week, and we got him in touch with Felix. And Felix is sharing a bit of the conversation he had with Jim, who is now 78 and had no idea the old recording existed or that Magic Radio Santa was a fixture in Centralia for decades.
I probably didn't know it existed from the time I was 7.1 years of age until just 2 days ago. I had no idea this was going on.
If I recall correctly, they mentioned you, and they say you want. Do you remember what you wanted for Christmas that year? Did you remember those things, or did that come flooding back, or was that a surprise?
No, the Red Ryder BB gun was not a surprise. That's something I wanted. The basketball was a surprise. I said, what the hell do I want a basketball for?
They also mention your brother, Timmy.
Tim is my younger brother. He was 14 months younger than I was, and I had no idea what he wanted.
It's from Timmy Hudson, and he says he's 6 years old. He says, I want a fire engine, a sled, a holster set with two guns, and the guns in it.
Yeah, no, that is keeping with my younger brother.
How so?
Well, just the fact that he wanted the guns.
Now, I think it also mentions your big sisters, Edna and Temple.
Right. They're half-sisters from a previous marriage of my father.
Uh-huh.
And please bring something for my two big sisters, Edna and Temple, and maybe some perfume or hair lotion.
No, I got amused when I heard that. I said, what? why would I have said, well, whatever. I mean, you're 7 years old.
That's pretty good. I mean, that's probably a pretty good guess for what Edna and Temple wanted 71 years ago for Christmas.
Well, the only one still alive now in the whole family is Temple. So, and she's no longer cognizant of what's going on around. So,
oh, I'm sorry. What did Santa bring you that year in 1950? Do you remember?
Felix, boy, I tell you, this is a challenge. First of all, I got a BB gun, but I don't think it was a Red Ryder. I keep thinking back because my father was trying to teach us gun safety. And as I recall, we got a BB gun with just a single, you had to load it by hand, one pellet at a time.
Got it.
And Red Ryder wouldn't have caught me short like that. I'd have gotten the real deal if I... But they were probably in demand. That's probably why I asked it, because they were hard to come by. But
how about it? Did you get a sailboat?
Actually, no. My father and I had a sailboat, and I've been on them a lot. But no, I run a powerboat.
Okay. And then no basketball?
Well, I've had basketballs over the years and whatnot, but I didn't get a basketball. I don't recall getting one.
Okay. And this didn't create some decades-long resentment in you for Santa kind of spurning you?
No, not at all.
Okay. And then it said, it said that your big brother, Eugene, was in Korea.
And he says, bring my big brother, Eugene, something too. I think he might be home for Christmas. He is in Korea.
Yeah, he was at the time 18 or 19, 18 or 19. He's 12 years older than I am. And he was shipped off. Well, he joined the Navy. They were just doing some sailing. He was a corpsman. And they got down off the, they changed direction. He said, we were out in the Pacific, changed direction. Next thing you know, they're going by a landmass. And they're getting everybody on helicopters with the medevac and everything.
Did he came home from Korea then?
He did come home from Korea. He spent his time over there and came home and went to college, joined the Washington State Patrol. So he was a patrolman for the state for almost 20 years.
So he since passed away?
He passed away last May at 90 years old.
Oh, man. Well, he had a good long life. But God, I wish he could have heard this recording.
Well, I did, too. That's what brought tears to my eyes, is that, I wish he would have heard it.
If we'd been a year ago or 2 years ago, Eugene and Tim could have heard this recording as well. That's kind of...
That's right.
How does that make you feel?
Well, I'm not happy. You wished otherwise, but in life, that's the way it is.
Yeah, I guess so.
There's always something else you can wish for, and that's just all it is a wish.
Yeah, I guess so. You're really easy to work with. I like that. Not everyone I talk to for radio stories is as easy and fun to work with as you, so I really appreciate it.
Well, good for you.
Thanks, Mr. Hudson.
Have a good day and a good holiday.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.
Felix Bunnell with Jim Hudson, who called into whose note was read on a radio show over 70 years ago in Centralia. Leave it to Felix to follow up on a 70-year-old Christmas list, right?
This morning's Daily Dose of Kindness is brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Last year, COVID interrupted a tradition that goes back more than a century. CBS's Mark Strassman is with the Santa Claus girls as they return to bring cheer to children in need.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
For more than a century, the Santa Claus girls have had West Michigan's longest Christmas list. All these cars, the parents of 6,000 needy children.
Merry Christmas!
That's what it's all about. It's helping the underprivileged children.
This is their only Christmas?
For some.
Yes, it is.
We try our best to give them something that they'll be excited about.
Inside this warehouse, tables stacked with gifts. 5 gifts apiece.
Well, look at that. Isn't that
including
cool?
A handmade hat and mittens. The Santa Claus girls, bringing Christmas to life here since 1908.
The love that the people have for giving back just doesn't go away.
Ask Liz Lemoncusa.
His checkerboard came from Santa Claus girls around 1940.
You're holding your mother's Christmas when she was 10 years old.
I know.
Her mother, Betty Girash, a Depression baby, died this June at 90.
It just warms my heart to see all these gifts and to know that someone else will have the joy that my mom had when she was younger.
In this line, we found the Carters.
We're doing the best we can right now during this time.
Looking to give their 6 kids a Christmas.
Without the help, it would be very tiny.
Some people just have a gift for giving.
The Santa Claus Girls, CBS's Mark Strassman. This is Seattle's Morning News. Jails have become de facto mental health institutions, and the question is, what do we do about it? Is there a way to handle somebody having a mental breakdown without calling the police? And is there a way to get that person healthy? And this segment was actually inspired by a listener, Meg in Everett, who is a longtime listener. She has an adult son living with mental illness. She has learned that the police are not a good way to handle cases like that, and she recommended that we call up Kaylee Fiedler Golka, who is the chief executive officer of an institution called Hero House Northwest. So, Kaylee, first of all, tell me about Hero House Northwest and what you do.
So Hero House Northwest is comprised of 3 clubhouses. We follow a psychiatric model of rehabilitation. So we're really kind of that next step after clinical treatment, after, you know, when people get to see their psychiatrists and their doctors, we really kind of add that community and that social community that's often lacking with people diagnosed and living with mental illness. As we know, isolation is a huge key factor. It's a big symptom of mental illness. So we've created some really well-rounded communities for people to attend on a day-to-day basis, to really get connected with others and to not be alone in the community. Mm-hmm.
So is this, you call it a clubhouse. So this is not like a halfway house. This is a meeting place?
Yes, correct. So people don't live there. They participate at their own whim, and they really get to decide how they utilize the clubhouse. So a really big cornerstone of the clubhouse model is that staff and members work side by side. So often in a clinical treatment, you have the patient versus the doctor, the provider. And oftentimes people don't have ownership of their own recovery. And the clubhouse offers that. Members pick and choose how they utilize the clubhouse, with which staff they work.
Can you give me an example of the types of cases you're equipped to handle and the types of cases that you cannot handle?
Yeah, so a really interesting facet of the clubhouse model is that we do not differentiate based off people's levels of functioning or what their diagnosis is. So the only requirement to enter and to become a member of the clubhouse is that you have a history of a diagnosed mental illness. Mm-hmm. That being said, we do have what we like to call our one rule within our community is to not disrupt or impact the recovery of another, meaning we don't want to have people in the community that are having violent behaviors or, right, or that they're unsafe to themselves or others.
Is there a way to measure your results?
Absolutely. So there's been over hundreds of peer-reviewed research articles written about us. Research is being conducted all the time on the clubhouse model, and it's proven outcome. We have outcomes that show the reduced hospitalization rates of members versus non-members, reduced incarceration rates. We even have higher job placement rates, so people getting back into the community, getting back into the employment. We even have higher rates of people returning to school and graduating.
Okay, so it sounds like what you're doing is working. So the question is, what does this mean for our attempts to fix whatever is wrong with policing? So is there a different way to handle a mental health crisis when it first appears, the thing that people now have to call 911 because they don't know what to do?
Absolutely. So this has been a big space that we've entered this past year and a half. We've noticed that a lot of our members have had really traumatic interactions with police, and it resulted in incarceration or, you know, being basically tossed in a county jail. And it was all because they were having a mental health crisis. And so I think when we approach something like this, we need, of course, it's a very big question, and it's not a simple answer to solve this. I think we need to have a care response model, meaning police are needed in the community to protect and serve, absolutely, but we also need to have a care response model that is comprised of peers and that is comprised of people who are really trained to handle these crises. And we know next summer there's going to be a new phone number coming out called 988, and it's going to be a mental health crisis number. Instead of calling 911, people can call 988.
But I'm thinking about the cases where people are acting out. They're out of control, mm-hmm, in public. And so you're going to have some kind of force presence to eliminate the danger. So they might go to jail as the first stop. But are you saying at that point, then you would be alerted and a mental health team would come in? How would that actually work on the ground?
Yeah. So I think, you know, they're trying out many different pilots, but one proven method that's actually been going on for 40 years is called the CAHOOTS model down in Eugene, Oregon. And a lot of us are trying to get that model up here in Washington, because the biggest thing is we don't want people to have to go to jail. We should stop criminalizing mental health crisis. And so the idea is that if somebody's, say, acting out or having a really tough time, want to send a team that knows how to de-escalate that situation.
Now, you're familiar with the list of so-called prolific offenders. This is what really gets people upset, that there's this revolving door. What percentage of these prolific offenders do it because of mental illness? And number two, when you have somebody who is doing it again and again and again, have you found the magic formula for interrupting that cycle?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, with the mental health, I think a lot of the times it's because it's untreated mental illness or mostly untreated substance use. And so that is one of the biggest issues, is that we have people that are you know, repeat offenders. They're constantly going in and out. It's that revolving door. It's a burden on the community. There's safety issues involved in that. I think we haven't found the proper setup or the proper intervention to be able to stop that cycle, because there's not enough investment in services on the outside.
It sounds like we're still missing that first piece where the people go for that initial treatment. Because once they've had the initial treatment, you're ready to keep them healthy. But there's got to be that intake part first. So you have three clubhouses in Bellevue, Seattle, and Everett. How many clubhouses do you think you'd need if you started getting a steady stream of people who need your services?
Yeah. So, I mean, the nice thing is that because of our advocacy work with the legislators and then the healthcare authority, we're helping to expand to 9 more clubhouses across the state. They won't be under us, but they will be part of the clubhouse community. I think we need a clubhouse in every single community, and we need, you know, those to be there for people, because when you don't have the appropriate services and you have the bare minimum, then that's where that cycle starts, because they can't access the proper treatment and they don't have anything pre and post hospitalization if it gets to that point.
Kaylee Fiedler Golka, Chief Executive Officer of Hero House Northwest. Kaylee, pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You can ring my
bell. Ring the bell. 8:47, Seattle's Morning News. Chinese food on Christmas Day has become an annual ritual for a lot of people, including Cairo's Rachel Bell, who talked with the owners of Seattle's oldest standing Chinese restaurant.
Soft noodles, okay.
Christmas is still days away, but Gordon Chan is already fielding calls for Christmas takeout orders at his dad's Chinese restaurant, Tai Tung.
That's on Christmas Day, right? Okay, we'll see you then.
For some, Chinese food in a movie is just as traditionally Christmas as Santa Claus and stockings.
Christmas is pretty hectic. Already we've got 20-some-odd reservations, and it's just gotten busier over time. Last year, I think, had a line that was probably hour, 2 hour wait. There seems to be a bigger influx over the last few years with regards to the number of customers.
Is Christmas your busiest day of the year?
It didn't used to be, but now it is for sure. Yeah, Mother's Day used to be by far our busiest day, but gradually over the last decade, Christmas has overtaken it significantly. And actually, Christmas Eve is probably the second busiest day of the year now.
I would argue that Chinese food in a movie used to be a primarily Jewish tradition. I myself have spent many Christmases with chopsticks in my hand. Last year, I even lit my menorah at my regular Chinese restaurant. But just like Gordon, I've also noticed that lines have gotten longer and longer on Christmas. And I know all these people aren't Jewish, so who are they? With at least 1,000 new people moving to Seattle every week, my guess is there are a lot of Christmas orphans not making it back home to be with their families.
That's part of the history when we first started here, is that there was a lot of people that came here, like immigrants from China, that were trying to make it better for their families. So they came here and they were by themselves.
Tai Tung is Seattle's oldest standing Chinese restaurant, still located in its original building on South King Street in the International District. Gordon's great-grandfather opened the restaurant in 1935, and today it's run by his dad, Harry Chan. Harry says even Bruce Lee was a regular. One of the cooks was his roommate for 2 years.
When you come in, you know, see, so you just want to sit down, you know, at the corner that we right now we dedicated to him. And his favorite dishes is oyster sauce beef with rice.
Most Americans are off on Christmas and Christmas Eve, but this is your busiest day. When do you get your vacation? When is your break? And are you guys ever closed?
We are open 365 days a year. So part of owning a Chinese restaurant is that we are open and accessible for people. So the question of when we actually have our kind of holidays, and Christmas in particular, we make it work. So for example, today I'm going to my in-laws for Christmas dinner, and so we kind of adjust. So for the gifts with the grandchildren, my dad will come home after we close at 10 or midnight, and then the kids, because they're still excited, will open gifts then, or we'll do it early in the morning before the restaurant opens.
The one exception in the 82 years the restaurant has been open was several years ago, when the business right next door to Tai Tung caught fire on Christmas Eve.
That night, we were forced forced to evacuate and basically close down the restaurant. And it was the first time ever that we had Christmas Eve and also Christmas Day together as a family at home, as opposed to at the restaurant. It was sad because we actually had reservations lined up. We enjoy serving the people, you know, providing them the food on that Christmas Day where a lot of other places aren't open.
Gordon grew up in Taitung. He started working the register behind the counter when he was just 6 years old.
I remember there are days that we'd start at, back then we opened at 9:30 and we closed at 3:30 in the morning. We do that whole full shift sometimes during the summer. Not often. I know I've got all the child labor law peoples right now listening to this.
And this Christmas Day, Gordon's children will be helping out. Three generations of Taitung family serving other multi-generational families who have been regulars at Taitung for decades.
More klezmer music, that's what I say. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.